You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is providing career pathway scholarships for current high school seniors and anyone else who has earned a high school diploma or GED to help fund an associate's degree or professional certification. Residents of seven counties in northern New Mexico may apply at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships, lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. The deadline is May 31st. I'm very happy now to welcome Matt Richtel. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for a series on distracted driving. And his new book is An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. Welcome.
Thank you very much. And if it's out there, a hello to my good friend and local resident, Doug Preston.
Yes, he's very much a friend of the show, and we're all fans of Doug Preston. First of all, I wanted to express my wonder and delight that you have written a book that is fundamentally about microbiology that reads like a gripping narrative. It's full of stories and even cliffhangers. How did you come to write this book in the first place about the immune system?
You're right. It is somewhat shocking. Someone would try to write a book about microbiology. You'd have to be either nuts or witness to a miracle, and it turns out I am both. I got a little bit of the crazy writer gene in me, Doug could attest, and I witnessed a miracle. Can I tell you about it?
Yes, please.
So I grew up in Colorado, and in high school, eons ago, in the 1980s, I had a close group of friends in high school. One of them was named Jason, and Jason was Mr. Everything. All-state baseball, all-state basketball, great-looking guy, got all the girls. And Jason, when he was 40, not 40, but in his early 40s, he got cancer. Long story, very short, it was this kind that's supposed to be curable, Hodgkin's lymphoma, if the radiation and chemo work out. In Jason's case, they did not. And Jason wound up 3 years ago with 15 pounds of tumor in his back, doubling every few weeks. And in Denver, his oncologist said, "Jason, I love you, buddy, but it's time to go home and die." Jason goes into hospice at home and says, or his family says, "Hey, what about that one drug?" That one drug was an immunotherapy drug called nivolumab, not yet sold for Hodgkin's lymphoma, not approved for it by the FDA. Very few tests had been done, one in the New England Journal of Medicine. Jason gets a hold of the drug through a process where you can get stuff in advance if there's nothing else left to help you. But remember now, he's got not just a foot in the grave, nine toes in the grave. He takes this. A few weeks later, his girlfriend wakes him up and says, "Jason, get out of bed. Your tumors have disappeared."
So that is an amazing story that has to do with a way of thinking about cancer and thinking about disease that is really a paradigm shift. And in order to talk about disease, in order to talk about the immune system, it's really important for us non-microbiologists, non-immunologists, to really think in terms of metaphors. And you have a wonderful metaphor for the human body, and that is that it's a festival of life. Explain what you mean by that.
So after this happened, I'm Jason's buddy, and I'm a New York Times health and science reporter. I say, okay, what the heck just happened? How does Lazarus rise? And I realize that I'm going to have to understand the immune system, because this drug is called immunotherapy. It involves tinkering with the immune system. So I set out on a completely fool's journey to understand the most challenging, incredible, complicated, sophisticated network in the known universe, I would say, next to the human brain.
Right.
And to do that, I had to understand even more fundamentally who we are. And who we are, if you put it in metaphorical terms, is we are this organism that is really a festival of life. Inside of us, there's a party going on. cells, molecules beneath cells, moving, transferring, organizing. And the thing about a party is it's both organized. If you go to a party, it's organized, little groupings, little cliques. Here, like organs, masses of cells that are like-minded and together, your pancreatic cells, your lung cells, and so on and so forth, but also lots of things mingling and moving. And in the midst of this, lots of things coming in and out of the body through food, through touch, through, all joking aside, picking your nose or scratching your nose, through inhalation. It is a take all comers bash. And so you have to ask, what incredible mechanism could protect us and enable us to survive when there's a party going on and virtually anything can get in and out of our bodies? And that's the starting point for asking, what is the immune system? What is this defense network? And how does it protect our festival of life?
It's such a compelling metaphor to see the body as this kind of community and both, as you say, kind of chaos and order and visitors to the party, friends and relatives. And it's the immune system's job within all that to keep us healthy. And a lot of the metaphors that are used to describe the immune system's components are things like, I mean, as you write, general, soldier, covert agent, sniper, suicide bombers. It's a lot of war metaphors. And yet it turns out that the immune system's function is not a kind of straightforward search and destroy mission. It's more like peacekeeping. What's going on?
Yeah, and I just want to tie this back momentarily to Jason. All roads lead back to his story and the stories of three other people in the book, because to understand health, longevity, and medicine, it's crucial that we understand how this defense network works. And I brought in to my reporting the grave misconception that you illuminate so well, that the immune system is this war machine. Here's the problem with it. Here you have this festival of life. If our immune system was a war machine that essentially attacked zealously every foreign entity, every bit of non-self it came across, our world would be truly scorched earth, nuclear winter. We would be in piles on the ground, because this festival of life exists in us and around us and is filled. We are filled with foreign organisms. They cover our arms. They live in our nostrils. They populate our gut. They are on our steering wheels, on our desks, on our clothing, on our pets, in our pets. And so were we to attack everything, it would be over. Much, much truer is that there is some of that violent capacity, some of that war machine capacity, but that it falls in a much broader context. And here, in a nutshell, is how I think about the immune system. It is part bouncer and part ballet dancer. It has the capacity, when it senses something that is dangerous, to bounce, to do extraordinary violence, as much violence on a micro level as you can fathom in a nuclear context. It seeks to do so while maintaining as much cooperation and harmony as possible. Diplomacy, if you will, is its first action. It seeks to tiptoe like a ballet dancer such that it doesn't create collateral damage that would harm us or the microbes that we live with in such harmony that they become our allies in survival.
Like gut flora.
Like gut flora. Look, your microbiome, which we tend to think of as being in your gut, but it's all the foreign organisms, the non-self that live on us and in us. We are their home, their host, their youth hostel, their cruise ship, their mansion. They want us to survive too.
Right.
And so they work with us, and in particular, they work and coordinate with the immune system in ways we are only now discovering to help keep us alive. We cannot go to war with everything that is different from us. We will perish.
Well, that's one of the amazing things about the immune system is it knows how to differentiate, at least most of the time, and we'll get to that, between self and other. In other words, it knows when there's a foreign body in the bloodstream, like a virus or a bacterium or a parasite. But not only that, it knows how to differentiate between healthy other, which we need in abundance, and dangerous other. That's a level of sophistication that's really quite incredible if you think about it.
Yeah, and the more you learn, weirdly, the more incredible it becomes. Like oftentimes things become pedestrian or prosaic as you learn about them. But the more you learn about this system, the more it forces the agnostic in me to say, wow, this is like, you know, this has the feel of the divine. And so by way of example, what you are describing is all these molecules that are very sensitive to different measures. For instance, is this me or is this something else? If this is me, is it infected by something that's dangerous or something that's not in dangerous or inhabited by or being broached by? If it's something else and not me, do I care to do anything about it? Meaning, if it's non-self and infected, do I care? All these are like algorithms, like math trees, like decision points that the immune system goes down. And to add on top of that, I want to say that there are really two, and you could make the case, as one reader said to me, three different immune systems inside the body. Would it be helpful to tell you about that?
Yes, please.
Here you've got your festival of life, and you get a poke of a stick, or you inhale a Klebsiella pneumonia that's multi-drug resistant, or you pick your what's known as an insult. An insult is when something attacks your body that could be or is a pathogen, a microbe, a problematic invader. Well, the very first thing that happens is the dispatching, the instantaneous dispatching, I should say, of what is called your innate immune system. This is a group of first responder cells and molecules that rush to the scene. The way I like to think of this very simply is you get a poke of a stick, it might have bacteria in it, onto the scene rush all these cells that are like your fire and police, your emergency responders, and they do a whole bunch of different jobs very well and promptly. First, they can swallow up some of these buggers from the outside, these germs, these bugs, for two purposes, to destroy them, to vanquish them, but also to get another part of the immune system involved. So I want to set that idea aside. Here's your first responders. I want to come back to them. And they rush to the scene. It's like a car site. They're seeking to contain the damage. They're seeking to set the stage to rebuild. And then you've got some of these first responders that are acting as a transmission system. And let me just pause and say, have I lost you? Are you still with me? Are you napping?
I'm still here, and I hope my listeners are too. So go ahead.
All right. So now you've got one of the first responders is called a dendritic cell. It swallowed up some of this bacteria that invaded your body, and it takes it to your lymph node. You go to the doctor, you know, under your armpit, your neck, your groin. They check to see if your lymph nodes are inflamed. Well, this is because those lymph nodes have begun building factories of your second kind of immune system called your adaptive immune system. These are filled with the specialized killers that can take out a very particular bacteria or virus. The first responders can do a generic response, but your adaptive immune system are your special operations forces. And that dendritic cell presents your adaptive T cells in particular, your B cells do this slightly differently, but they give your adaptive cells a taste of the bacteria or virus. They say, which soldier out there knows how to kill this thing? And that's when your adaptive immune system begins to ratchet up its factories and attack that bacteria or virus. It's the second layer, the precision killers that come into play.
So when we feel sick, we get an infection like a virus or a bacterium or getting, you know, poked with a stick and getting a reaction to it. The symptoms are caused as much by the body's response to the pathogen as the pathogen itself. Is that right?
Yeah, and I would say almost entirely. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's hard to disentangle your symptom from your inflammation, but what you are feeling, the fever, the fatigue, the slight disorientation, the loss of energy, all of that is your body's defenses ratcheting up and causing you to feel fatigued. Your resources are being shifted over to battle.
And it's not only that the resources are being shifted over to battle, there's another adaptive component to that, which is slow the heck down. Don't move that part of your body now, because if you do, it'll get worse.
Yes. This question you ask is a really interesting one, which is, to what extent do you need to slow down in order to allow healing to work? And the answer is more complicated and I think more interesting than I ever imagined. And to get at it, I have to give you another piece of it, which is the role of stress in the immune system. I want you to picture yourself being chased by a lion in the Serengeti 5,000 years ago. You got that mental picture in your mind?
Oh, yeah.
Are you scared? You need to be scared.
We're working on it.
Okay. So in that moment, your body is letting off some really important neurochemicals, and it's letting off some steroids. And these things are focused entirely on helping your body endure the acute moment of the lion's threat. Your body is shifting resources in that moment away from your innate and adaptive immune systems toward these all hands on deck survive the moment. To put it simply, when you're running from a lion, the head cold can wait. So how does this connect to the question you asked about telling your body to slow down? It's conceivable that when you get a cold or a flu or something else, your body needs all its energy to fight, and so it's helpful for you to rest. But another way to think about it is, when you are not resting, there are all kinds of low-level stressors that you're putting on yourself that are actually undermining or shifting resources away from your immune system. In order to be energized when you're sick, you have to almost get your adrenaline pumping. And that adrenaline system shifts away from your immune system, and so you make yourself sicker. The reason I mention this is, it's very tempting. This is a really important point that I've had to learn over and over because I'm a knucklehead. And I sometimes think when I feel sick, well, I'm just going to work my way through it. I wind up making myself sicker, not only because I'm not giving myself the resources to heal, but also because I'm creating adrenaline in order to allow myself to work that actually is undermining my immune system. Those are two related but different mechanisms. And in today's kind of type A society, we can really do damage to our healing.
Very much so. And another piece of that, I mean, stress is not good for supporting the immune system. It's antithetical to it. And so is lack of sleep. And you write a lot about this as well.
Lack of sleep is probably the number one thing most under your control that holds the tiller on your immune system. You used a word I want to emphasize, which is balance. You want your immune system in balance. You don't want to boost it. This is a big misconception. We can come back to it later. But for the moment, keeping your immune system in balance means sleep. When you sleep, you shut down that adrenal system that can undermine your immune system. Or put another way, when you don't sleep, you often keep your adrenal system going. And you wind up in nickels and dimes stealing from your immune system. And it doesn't take much. It can take a single night of poor sleep. So you can imagine that people who get on their devices late, night after night, don't honor their sleep regimens, and so on and so forth, are beginning to tick away at their immune system on a regular basis, leading to both acute and chronic illness.
And you write about some people in your book. You've mentioned Jason, and there are several others. And one of the things that's really interesting and important to think about is that there are diseases that are caused by an immune system failing to do its job, like cancer, and then other ones that are an overactive immune system that's doing too much of a job, like rheumatoid arthritis, other autoimmune diseases, and even allergies. So those are kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to think about autoimmune disorders and cancer as opposite sides of the same coin. But well said, you can in some ways really think about them that way, in that cancer is a case of the immune system failing to react to a cancer. And it does so because cancer plays a trick on the immune system and says, ignore me, I am much like you, I am self, you just go about your business. But in the case of autoimmune disorders, in contrast, there's the immune system attacking your own self,
right?
The joints, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, Crohn's, go down the list, they are becoming very prominent, and they are in particular prominent in women.
Why is that?
Well, we don't exactly know why, but I think the overriding theory, and is outlined in the book and illuminated through several case studies, I talk about these really remarkable women, Linda and Meredith, who suffer these. It's because women have a stronger immune system to begin with. Women confer immunity to children through gestation and through breastfeeding. They have, through an evolutionary biological sense, been caregivers. They have, or tend to have, more fatty cells, which means more immune cells. Well, there's some good news associated with this. Not a news flash here. Women live longer. But the deal is that means they've got a stronger bouncer in that balance between bouncer and ballet dancer. And over time, and this is just sort of an axiom, this is axiomatic, over time, our immune system tends to fall out of balance a little bit, like any system. And so if you're predisposed to have a stronger bouncer, as time goes by, as we age, the women are more likely, having had a stronger bouncer to begin with, to see the bouncer overtake the ballet dancer. Hence autoimmune disorders, and hence as we live longer, which is bittersweet in this context, autoimmune disorder on the rise.
Then going back to cancer, I think one of the things that's so insidious and at the same time interesting about cancer is that, I mean, we're talking about the immune system recognizing self and other. Well, cancer cells are a mutation of our own cells, so they look a lot like self. So it's like your cousin went psycho and moved into your house and is eating your food, but he's still your cousin, so you don't want to kick him out. Cancer tricks the body into thinking that this mutated cell is friendly, and yet at the same time, our body does get rid of some cancer cells. What's going on?
Yeah, so here's the thing about a cancer cell, and let me say a word about smoking in this context and why this helps explain why smoking is so deadly. But we have cancers inside us all the time. Cancer is, in the broadest sense, a growth of a cell that is a mutation. And they happen all the time. We have to have cells grow, or every time we got a nick and cut, every time a cell died, if we didn't replace our cells, we'd just erode like a hill of sand. So the body must make room for new cell division. In the course of that, like any manufacturing process, whether at the greatest manufacturing plant in the world or one that's got some deficiencies, there's always going to be, you know, things that come out of the factory that aren't quite right. Those are cancers when they're cells. Most of those malignancies die of their own weight. They're just so rotten from the core that they perish, or the body's immune system recognizes them as being alien and eats them, or gasses them, or poisons them, or shoots them, or pick your insidious mechanism, because we have all those inside of us. But sometimes a mutation comes along that is particularly insidious because it looks a lot like us, but then it does something else bonus. It does something really nasty. It sends a signal to the immune system that says, stand down, I'm self. Now, why in the world would our immune system be built such that it has the ability to recognize a signal, stand down? Well, now you guys have the context to understand that's actually an essential part of the immune system. That is the ballet dancer being told tiptoe lightly, and for good reason. Because if we don't have balance, we will attack everything and scorched earth. You can make a case, I can make a case based on my research, that half the molecules in the immune system are designed to put the brakes on it rather than have it accelerate. So here comes a malignancy that has figured out how to send a message that says stand down. And just to give another idea of how important this is, if the immune system didn't get a message that said stand down, I'm self, we'd never be able to grow all those new cells.
Right.
The cancer's taking advantage of one of the most important survival mechanisms we have to kill us. In the case of Jason's cancer, what immunotherapy does is take the brakes off the immune system so that it attacks. But before I go further, can I just say one word about smoking?
Yeah.
When you smoke, you create wounds all the time inside your lungs, which means that you are creating new cell division all the time to fill the lapsed spots in your lungs. But simultaneously, when you inhale all that smoke, you're inhaling particles that have the simultaneous effect of causing your DNA to reproduce in a malignant fashion. It is simple math. If you smoke enough, you are going to get one of those cancers that through random mutation can send the signal to your immune system, leave me alone. It is a form of eyes wide open suicide.
So this is such an interesting thing because we know that smoking causes cancer, and you've explained to us in a little more detail how that works. Same with air pollution and junk food and all kinds of toxic things that we do to ourselves or that are in our environment. And we can tax our immune system beyond its capacity. So for example, things that eliminate some of those pathogens, like chlorination, you know, was a life-saving innovation, especially for city dwellers. But then if we stay too clean, especially as kids, if we don't play in the dirt and put things in our mouths and so on, that's also bad for our immune system. So there's some like happy medium. Explain how you think about that.
Yeah. So happy medium is a great way to put it. But just to establish the point, the very fine point you brought up, the way the ballet dancer and the bouncer learn how to relate to the world, how to know what to attack and what to leave alone, is through practice. They have got a lot of test cases to know when do they go forward and when do they withdraw. And that data comes from preschool. It comes from nature. It comes from walking in the dirt. It comes from rubbing your nose. We know this. You know this, listeners, because when your kids go to preschool, you know they're going to get sick a bunch, but that's also training their immune system to understand what's what. One of the things that we have done in society, and you could say this overall with one example over the after the next through the Industrial Revolution and its aftermath, is as we have gotten good at fixing our environment through industrial means, we have often overcorrected. Another great example of this, just to explain what I mean, is processed foods or the processing or industrialization of food. It's gotten more calories to more people in more places. That's great. But it's also led to obesity through processed, high caloric, high sugar and fat foods. We have overcorrected in our effort to deal with the basic idea of starvation, and we're learning how to deal with that. Similarly, when it comes to cleanliness, We learned over the eons past that a dirty environment was very dangerous. You could see what many cultures have done. You know, some didn't eat certain animals because animals carry a lot of pathogens. You know, you can see, and I quote in Exodus, the idea of ritual hand washing going way back when to try to get away from these pathogens that could kill us willy-nilly. But we overcorrected when we started pouring goop all over our hands every time we touch a doorknob, every time we get on an airplane, every time we shake hands. What do I mean by overcorrect? Well, we start starving our ballet dancer and bouncer of the inputs that they require to make good decisions. Am I making sense there?
Yeah.
When you say happy medium, I think we have to recognize that we've overcorrected. And I think we have to recognize that some amount of illness, a head cold, even an occasional flu, I mean, they're very dangerous in certain people, but an occasional flu, an occasional virus, they're part of the process of interacting in the world. And I think the idea that we will never get sick or never have an immune system response is missing what the big picture is. That's very different from smoking, where the introduction of a bunch of really noxious foreign chemicals that we understand to kill us is something that will help our immune system.
All of this that you're talking about, as you know, we started out talking about how these are metaphors, and one of the metaphors that you talk about in the book is the social metaphor based on the immune system. When you have, for example, a police culture that's continually turning against its own citizens, self, based on things like race and class, it seems an awful lot like an autoimmune disease.
Yeah, I tried to be apolitical in this book because I don't believe science is political. These are just facts. I do remark, though, that to take a case we can surely all agree on, Hitler, what Hitler did in trying to cleanse or purify his nation in the name of self wound up behaving like an autoimmune disorder. It was blind, raging nationalism that defined self so narrowly that it nearly brought down the world and certainly his nation state. And where we can learn from the immune system is understanding that its longevity owes to cooperation, harmony, and surgical strike, not scorched earth, not trying to cleanse the world of everything that seems a little bit foreign, because for the most part, the sharing through harmony of our world by the immune system is what has allowed us to survive as a species and thrive as individuals.
Well, and that's another piece of the story, which is the importance of diversity and the fact that we're all different, that our immune systems are slightly different from one another. That's extremely adaptive. And failing to see that diversity, both on the micro and the macro level, is very important, is really a social problem, isn't it?
You know, it's such a simple way to think about it, but if we all had the same immune system, we would no longer exist. And what I mean by that is some people survived the flu pandemic of 1918. Some people survived the Black Plague. Some people survived the bird flu. Well, many did. But some people survived HIV. If you do not have a diverse immune system, meaning if you do not have a diverse population, we would perish from a single pathogen. So this is, again, this is not political. This is simple science and simple math. And I do mean simple. Diversity is the lifeblood of our survival. So those who would seek to have a kind of purified culture or purified gene pool have, I would suppose, zero understanding of the science. And when I say culture, the other thing I mean here is the life-saving, I can't put a fine enough point on this, the life-saving medicines and discoveries that save Jason, but that are saving people every day, came from an international body of scientists working collaboratively. The immune system, all the revelations that are redefining medicine come from an international cadre of scientists. That means cooperation, not isolation. It's simple fact. There's nothing remotely political about that idea.
Yeah. I was thinking as I was reading your book, and I've thought about this a lot in the past as well, the question of whether we organize our society in the ways we do, is that kind of like an unconscious representation of our inner world? You know, policemen and telecommunications and ballet dancers and bouncers and all these things. I mean, these things exist inside us. We create those things outside of us. Is there a relationship between those two?
Yeah. Most surely there is, in the sense that what has survived for long before we existed, the immune system took its fundamental shape 480 million years ago. Its effectiveness bespeaks its rationality. It works. And therefore, as we have come up with civil society and with systems, it's not that we're mimicking it or even that subconsciously we understand it and therefore reproducing it. It's that we have come to it over time through the same kind of process as genetics, but here it's memes. Here it's ideas honed like a stone with the rivers washing over it through time. We have come to very similar ideas because they work. And just like an evolutionary process, as we come up with better ideas, say democracy, they begin to take hold the way at one point an adaptive immune system became part of our process because it worked better.
Right. I also kind of wonder whether our ways of dealing with societal and international conflict will change or can change as our paradigms of disease and treatment change. Do you know what I mean?
Here's the optimist in me. I know there are a lot of people feeling rotten about this day and age, but I would say I tend to be a cup half full person. I think we've made unbelievable progress in moving towards better survival mechanisms. And there are times when the world faces a disease or perceives a disease, and different people have different definitions of those things. But I think we are getting better and better at figuring out as a society how to deal with those things. And sometimes diseases are more noxious than others. And when diseases come along, just like we need diverse immune systems, we need diverse ideas that become the immunity, that become the survival mechanism in those moments. I guess I'm hopeful that, as we have seen over time, this species does seem to have the capacity to come up with ideas that enable our survival in profound ways.
Your word in dog's ear. The book is called An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. And I would just like to say before we go that, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the science, which I think is just so fascinating and really important to understand. But the through line, and you've talked about this, of the book is your friend Jason. And we get such a vivid picture of his wonderful personality, of his struggles. And ultimately, it's very much a story of vulnerability and mortality, because no matter how consciously and lovingly we treat ourselves, these systems will break down.
Yeah.
And the acceptance of that and the ability to kind of be in the party until it's over is one of the big takeaways, at least for me, from your book.
I walked away learning so much, both through Jason's story, and then there's three other characters in it who lent me their souls. And to put a fine point on what you said so elegantly, I've learned to hold two contradictory truths at the same time. One is we want to hope and dream of more time and innovate and grow and figure out and unlock ways to live longer and healthier while simultaneously accepting that death is not only inevitable, but essential for the survival of the species. And as you will discover, those who are interested in the book, the immune system even helps us along in that regard. Our very defense network has built-in ways of helping kill us to preserve the species over the individual. We have to be hopeful and accepting simultaneously. No small task.
Matt Richtel is a reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the LANL Foundation for their support. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.